Time out.
What?
I didn't realize what was happening. Restart this.
I just was asking. I'm trying to get levels.
Oh,
I'm trying
okay.
to get levels on the mic.
I thought you were fishing for intro fodder.
Maybe a little bit of that. But
I never know when you're just talking or when you're actually like fishing for like the beginning of a podcast, waiting for me to say something witty.
Still waiting.
I've been waiting for 60 years.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and that was the voice of my often and recurring co-host, St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist Ben Fredrickson. We are talking to you after recording our first video teaser for the podcast, so we're trying something new, and we are still social distant. So, but I did get to see you in person briefly at a distance, which was really nice. That was good over the weekend last week to see you.
It was great, and I had forgotten what you'd looked like, and then I was reminded because I saw you, and I also saw your son Ian, who is morphing into an identical twin of sorts, which is very remarkable. Every time I see him, he's like a foot taller. It's quite impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. He definitely had, I mean, he's always had a resemblance to me. But now with the glasses and the baseball cap, it's basically like reliving early years of high school. When I look at him, which is something, I guess it's a compliment.
It'll be great because he's going to start high school here in the this next year, and then when he goes to college, he can just use your ID as his fake ID.
Yeah, that'll work. I hope he, maybe he'll probably have more hair than me, so maybe that'll throw it off.
My problem in college was remembering the random name and address, but if you can use your father's, then it's really you know, hard to screw that up when they ask you for birthday and address and all that stuff.
I think I'm starting to understand why he's so why he talks so much about trying to be as tall as me. So maybe that's what it is.
Exactly.
Good point.
He could say, "Well, you need a second form? Here's my baseball writer's card."
Yeah, Ben, I'm returning from a week. We don't say on assignment because I was not allowed to do any assignments. So the furlough week. Did anything happen while I was gone? Anything in baseball happen? Anything going on in baseball?
There was a lot of, I don't know, I would say a lot of news, but there was certainly a lot of bluster. So you missed a lot of hot air and posturing, and the side swiping continues. So that's pretty much where we're at, man. I mean, we have a plan that could bring baseball back as the owners would prefer it to try to come back. A plan that hopes to navigate around coronavirus, which we'll see if any league is able to do that. However, there seems to be a pretty significant distaste for this plan by the players union, which has to agree. And it's on a couple levels. And we talked a little bit about this a little bit in the video briefly, but there's really two hangups. And one is the money. And that goes back to that March 26th agreement and the interpretation of it. And two sides have very differing opinions on that. And then the other is going to be the health precautions. And I think there's a lot more palatable debate going on about that. But the fight about money is getting the most attention, and it seems to be getting uglier by the day.
And it does speak to kind of the parallel tracks of the conversation for Major League Baseball, the way you spelled it out there. It is the precautions that are necessary for the game to return and the motivations that are present for the game to return. The precautions are all the health, all the granular, detailed, expert approved, government allowed details that are in there that will have no fans at games, that will have constant testing, which will like repurpose a testing facility for minor league drug tests. We'll repurpose that for high speed COVID-19 and antibody testing. I mean, everything is in there that you would think of, including no spitting, social distancing in the dugout. Some of these things that are really more that to me are more optic than substantive, but they're in there and they're spelled out, and Major League Baseball will have to defend why they're doing it. And then the other part of that is the motivation for the game's return. And that is as clear as anything. It's the most clear motivation of all. And that's money, revenue on both sides, and how they split that pot and why it's important for them to come back. I think they can dress that up and put some, you know, they can put some rouge on it and make it sound like they're coming back for the best of baseball, for the best of America, to be part of the revitalization, the return, the reopening, however you want to put it. But they're driven by the fact that there is cash at stake, there's revenue at stake, and they would like to find some way, somehow, to get to the pot of gold at the end of a shortened season, which is the playoff TV rights holder thing. You know, that and the money that comes with that. So I think we can get into all of that. We can get into the granular levels, but really folks need to keep, you know, in mind that it's these two parallel tracks are operating, and the union and the owners don't exactly agree on either side of them, but they're traveling down them. One is precaution and one is the money motivation. Before we get into that, though, I want to tell people about the Best Podcast in Baseball sponsor. Best Podcast in Baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. Ben, Closets by Design is the official sponsor of the Best Podcast in Baseball. And the Best Podcast in Baseball has a bit of a curveball coming up, right? Our video teaser attempt was my first foray, your second foray, third foray into what we're going to be doing at the Post-Dispatch 1 week from when we're recording this, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're doing our first virtual STL Sports on Tap. It's presented by Scotsman Coin and Jewelry. It will be at 7:15 p.m. That's on Wednesday, May 27th. And for folks who've had a chance to come to the Sports on Tap events in person before, they're pretty fun. I mean, we get all the gang together, a collection of different sports writers from across the Post-Dispatch sports team, and we just talk sports, Cardinals baseball, Blues hockey, Mizzou football and basketball, or anywhere else that the audience kind of wants to take us. The difference will be this time you don't have to leave your couch. It will be a Zoom round table, if you will, and we're going to take questions from the audience that kind of rolls through a chat function tied into the video. If folks are interested, they can check it out at stltoday.com/ontap. It's free, and you can even register early, and that allows you to submit your questions ahead of time.
Are you going to get a haircut before doing this?
Well,
are you going to give yourself a haircut before this?
Well, I'm actually glad it's a little ways away still, because my quarantine cut is still growing out, but I might have to find some way to do some touching up before our big event here. But if it would have happened, you know, a week, 2 weeks ago, I would have looked a little, I would say, convict-y in my video, because I had a pretty close cut there. Went with the beard trimmers. There was some missing. It wasn't a good look, let's be honest, but it has grown out quite a bit. So that's good news for everybody involved.
It's a week away, the Sports on Tap, the virtual Sports on Tap via Zoom. And by then there'll be a whole host of other questions, because one of the things we've definitely learned here, especially as drips and drabs of how baseball plans to return have come out. You know, some of the ideas floated early. You know, it was like, it's Arizona or bust, and then it was bust, but come up with something else. So one of the things that we've seen definitely is Major League Baseball exploring all sorts of options for a return, troubleshooting it, even floating some of it publicly in the sense that it could then be poked holes in it or players could push back before like a formal proposal. That's not unusual. You know, these trial balloons, basically Major League Baseball has at times used the media, the fans, or, you know, the players' comments as focus groups for what they could do to return, but also kind of test driving things with the experts. What we have now is slightly different. It's obviously more detailed. It's more formal. You know, the 67-page proposal that Major League Baseball delivered to members clubs. There was an interview with the Colorado governor in The Athletic where he mentioned that he had a chance to see it. Governors in Texas, California, and New York have all kind of urged for pro sports to return. Some of them specifically mentioning baseball being played in front of empty stadiums. So there is more detail and heft to this proposal than the previous ones that were kind of floated out there. Does that give you any optimism? Is heft a sign of optimism, or does it just lead to, like I said, a week from now, we'll just have more questions?
Well, I think it's optimistic that there is a formal proposal that has been produced to the players' union. Everything else before that was speculative, and they were clearly workshopping some things and you know, leaking, quote, some of it is, that's generous. I mean, they've leaked everything. The owners have. We've seen every, I feel like we've been reading for weeks leading up to this, like the dream journal these owners are keeping on the side of their bed. Like every time they think of something that might work, we hear about it. And I don't know if that helped or hurt, but clearly some of the ideas were not going to fly, including putting everybody in Arizona. I think this is encouraging because, look, if the players agreed with it, we would be in motion now. You know, that's the difference. You know, there was never a formal proposal presentation made to the players about any of these other plans. This is the one. Now, it's going to have to shift and adapt some. There have been meetings, you know, virtual meetings between these two sides about this plan. So right. That's a step forward. Now, a step forward boldly going nowhere could be, we'll see. But I think there's a clear difference there between throwing things on the wall and seeing what sticks and actually presenting something to the union to say, hey, here's what we came up with. Now, how do you see it?
A significant sticking point on both sides is the agreement that was in place in March. Just to kind of rewind a little bit, Major League Baseball around March 13th, Friday the 13th, you know, they're making the decision as to pausing their season. And then a few days later, Monday of that next week, so, you know, the 16th, right before St. Patrick's Day, just to give people kind of a timeline, you and I are talking to Commissioner Rob Manfred outside the Cardinals complex there in Jupiter. Owner Bill DeWitt Jr. is also there. And it's at that point in time that Manfred tells us, look, they're shutting camps. They are dispelling with formal workouts. And it was also at that point in time he said, look, you know, the original target date of a delayed return of April 9th, that's not happening. It's pushing back another 8 weeks. That pushed it into the point we are now, where those words that he spoke that day extended the delay to where we are right now in mid-May. It also was prelude to the agreement that they had with the union when they started to recognize, look, there's going to be a shortened season. Everybody wants to play as many games as possible, but there's going to be a shortened season. And because of that, they needed to come to agreements on, you know, per diems, stipends, how to pay lost wages, how to do service time, were rosters frozen, some of these things that were in the air. But one of the big things, and that's the sticking point, is this notion that the union at the time felt that the owners were saying, well, we'll pay you a prorated salary for whatever games there are. And the owners have pushed back and said that was the agreement at the time, but that was contingent on fans being in the stands. Now we have to do something different. There was an email that the New York Post, Joel Sherman, got a hold of that sort of detailed that and gets to the crux of this conflict, right? Where the union says, you know, stick with the agreement we had, which is prorated salaries, and owners pushing back saying, you knew all along that if fans weren't going to be in the stands, the revenue was going to change. So the agreement was going to have to change.
It's funny that you mentioned that day in Jupiter, because I remember us talking to Manfred and asking specifically, could you see a season in which you play without fans in the stands? And at the time, the idea of that was almost still just crazy to think about. And he kind of said, basically he didn't want to get into that because, you know, and it was hard to blame him at the time, but that is really what this debate about the revenue is going to come down to. It comes down to what owners feel like they're going to lose by having a shortened season without, you know, ticket and, you know, attendance, you know, revenue coming in. And the players, if they believe that or not. And I think really what you're seeing here is what's going to make things very complicated to get this season going. It's what's going to make things very complicated after the 21 season when the new CBA has to go into effect and has to be negotiated. These sides don't trust each other. And they don't and they're done hiding it. You know, players are mad going back for years, but especially lately with the, you know, the drastic changes in free agency, with the claims that teams are all valuing players the same way, whether it's just by randomness or by something darker than that. And the players feel this is another way to, you know, for the owners to try to back them into a corner and then put the public spotlight on them and claim they're the bad guys. And I think they're tired of it. We're seeing that in the comments made by the union. I mean, reading that really informative article from Joel Sherman, it's great reporting by him to get a hold of that. But you also have to say this is exactly the kind of stuff that didn't need to get out and shouldn't get out if you have two sides that are working with one another. You know, how much have we seen, you know, compare it to the NHL, Derek? I mean, the NHL right. is having these same conversations, you know, but we're not hearing about scathing emails leaking out between the NHL players and the owners, because, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if hockey's back first because they're able to make up more ground faster. And we'll see it. I mean, we'll see. But it just seems like there's so much animosity here, and it's revolving around how they interpret this March 26 agreement. And I also remember that same day talking to Andrew Miller and asking him, hey, do you think this is going to be kind of an early litmus test for how things are going to go between the league and the players when it comes to, you know, CBA talks and everything? Could this be a step in the right direction? And he said very cautiously, look, we haven't really negotiated anything yet about what this looks like when it comes back. And basically said the hard part's going to come when it comes time to play games again. And he completely right. predicted it. And that's exactly what's happened. So, you know, look, I don't know. I mean, the worst case scenario is that this debate about what was agreed to in late March has to be decided by a third party. And that's going to take forever. And that's going to be really harmful for the timeline of trying to get this thing up and running by July.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why baseball wants to get up and running by July is because, you know, this is reality, is they want to squeeze as many games into this narrow window. They're basically see a keyhole of opportunity for them to try to get the season off the ground, play the games, get as many games in, 81, 82, 100 if the players push for it, games. Before the fall arrives and the concern of a second wave of the virus, you know, they are trying to thread that needle. That's one of the reasons for the push here. That's one of the reasons they're motivated to get this done, is because they see like this narrow bandwidth of an opportunity to play baseball, empty stands, get through their postseason, reach that pot of gold for the rights fees, and then get out of there before the threat of a second wave of the virus comes in and creates new policies, possibly. They have to prepare for that. And, you know, I was talking with somebody yesterday just about this, and it's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like the end of Star Wars, where they have one shot at this small little square to make the whole thing happen. And the longer they wait, the more interference they run into. You know, the more arguments they have, the smaller that window gets, and all of a sudden it's gone, which, you know, maybe there's a party that doesn't mind that. If they're going to lose money while paying players' salary with empty stadiums, maybe we have to question, you know, what the owner's stomach is, that quote unquote puke point that we talk about with trades. Maybe it's there for the owners. What's the puke point to bring the game back?
Well, the idea that the owners are going to lose more money by not having some sort of a season that could lead to a postseason, then, you know, you're gonna come out on the wrong end by not having a season compared to trying to salvage one. I have a hard time believing that, especially if they can get to the postseason. Now the owners,
well, that's the big key.
The owners are claiming that they're going to lose money by playing games, even if they split the revenue. And the players are saying, we don't buy that. And the players are saying also, send us the information that proves that. You know, it's one thing to project something and give it to the Associated Press and say, here are our losses. You know, this is why we can't do that. And that's fine. But unless you're going to show the work and show the math, then I think the players are right to say, we need to see these numbers. anybody would want to see those numbers. So I don't blame
Absolutely.
Them. I don't blame them for asking for that. And if the owners are telling the truth, then they shouldn't have a problem providing that information. How revenue is defined and what means the revenue loss seems to be very fuzzy math when it comes to some of these, you know, some of these people speaking on the owner's behalf. And the players also, you know, I think have a point to make where they say, look, we, whether or not you agree with what they agreed to on March 26th, they're putting they're at more at risk than the owners because they're the ones going out playing. They're at higher risk of contracting the virus. And they're also, you know, they're also the people who are, you know, going and traveling and doing all these things that the owners don't have to do. So, you know, they're also wise to be wary of a revenue split 50-50 if there's such a diminished chance of potentially having a postseason because that's where the money is made. So, you know, that they have to think about that too, just like the owners do. They can come up with a plan and they can have everything hunky-dory and lollipops and rainbows, but the virus could derail this thing by the time that they get to the postseason. So the players are concerned about that in addition to the health, and I get that. What I don't understand, and this seems to be mentioned, but it doesn't seem to be mentioned at all by people who actually have an influence on this. What is the problem with owners saying, hey, you know, let's rethink this. You know, the players have such a resistance to do a salary cap, you know, anything that could lead to a salary cap. But why don't, you know, they say, hey, if you do a revenue split for a season, we will defer the difference from the prorated portion of the salary back to when baseball gets its books in order and gets up and running again. There's been almost no talk of deferred payments to the players if there's some sort of a compromise. Hopefully that comes, because to me, that seems like the most obvious way at trying to bridge the gap here.
Yeah, it's part of it. It's interesting because usually in collective bargaining agreements, right, one of the big topics that takes a lot of time to hash out is the definition of revenue.
Right.
And the union has long been suspicious of how Major League Baseball owners define that. We can point to something simple as the revenue from MLB Network, right? So that's owned by the 30. That's owned by the 30 owners. So they benefit from MLB Network and its revenue. But is that considered a revenue stream that then is carved up? And the players have every right to ask that. Like, where is that money go? Where is that part of the definition? Because if you're saying that that's part of a company outside of the individual teams or beyond the league and does not then count into the revenues, then there is a uncut straight stream of revenue from one place straight to the owner's pockets without ever being, you know, filtered by what they have promised to pay the players. So this is usually a definition that takes months to argue over, and they're trying to microwave it by, you know, just like getting it into the thing, press a few buttons, and then come out with, you know, a completed definition of the revenue. It's a fascinating thing because the clock is running. And meanwhile, Blake Snell's on Twitch and, you know, offering an unvarnished look at what players, you know, one player's opinion, probably shared by multiple players. I mean, we see that social media has sort of allowed players to speak out individually on this and offer up their thoughts, maybe in more ways than ever before, which is just a wonderful modern twist on the CBA because the players have their voice. They can, you know, you have Trevor Bauer can get on video with his agent and scoff at the proposal to return. You have Blake Snell on Twitch. You have little commentaries all around blossoming. I even saw there were some active minor leaguers who have been critical of the 5-round draft on Twitter. So I think that's an interesting aspect of it. However, it's hard to say that they're a chorus or that they're all arguing, you know, under one voice. And then into that mix comes Blake Snell. What were your thoughts on his? I found, and I apologize for not knowing this, Ben, but I found that I had to almost defend him a lot in the chat that I hosted at stltoday.com. Was it a similar kind of tone in your chat? And what was your thoughts?
Well, I don't defend Blake Snell much, other than he has a right to say what he thinks. I think he put himself in a bad spot, and I think he, more importantly, probably did some damage to the players' side of this by not being informed. I'm all for strong opinions. I really enjoy listening to Trevor Bauer talk about this stuff because he actually has been informed. Now, he says some things that are outlandish sometimes, but that's part of offering an opinion that people pay attention to. What frustrated me about Blake Snell, and it, you know, part of it is the old man in me that goes, hey, you probably shouldn't be talking about how you want to make your millions while you're playing video games. I don't know that the optics on that were great, but I'm old and getting older by the day, I think. But my most important beef with that
was just because of all the podcasts you do.
Right. Yeah. He wasn't informed, Eric. And that's what frustrated me. You shouldn't make yourself the face of this argument if you don't know what you're talking about. Blake Snell did not seem to have a good grasp of the agreement players agreed to on March 26th. He didn't seem to have a good grasp of the agreement owners were asking players to shift to. And instead, it made it sound like he wasn't going to play baseball at all in 2020, which that's not what he meant. And I know that because he's since had to clarify his comments. But it was too late because no one reads the clarification of comments anymore. They take the one thing that went viral, and that becomes the story. So I'm sure that there are some players who echoed his opinions, but they should think before they share them in that way. You know, there are much better ways to make your statement, and they have more outlets now than ever before to use them. And it's frustrating, at least to me, to see them, you know, have members who are not informed become the people who are getting the most attention. I think that's disappointing. I mean, that same day, you had Rob Manfred delivering his side of the story
on CNN.
And I pointed that out, and I got a lot of, well, a lot more people watch Twitch than CNN. And that might be true, but those people aren't buying tickets to Major League Baseball games. I can guarantee you that. If you put up the pie chart of people who watch CNN versus people who stream Twitch, I have a pretty good bet on who's spending more money when it comes to, you know, helping Major League Baseball make a lot of money. And maybe that's going to change over time, but I think players should be a little more aware of that. They have unlimited opportunities now to get their point out, and I think they do a very poor job of it. I mean, imagine if Kurt Flood had Players Tribune, Derek. What he had written for that? I mean, these guys don't take sometimes the opportunities that are made available to them. And I thought Snell took an opportunity to set the discussion back, and that's why I was frustrated by it. I thought he did a disservice to his peers, and I imagine, hopefully, that he's heard that from some of them.
Boy, I think you made some really good points there. I don't want to walk along with you there with that he took a step back, in part because I think any conversation at least offers an opportunity to move forward. And for so long, you know, we have talked about how players cloak themselves in cliches and how hard it is to get an honest answer from them. And then all of a sudden you do get one, and just because we don't like the optics of it or don't like the tone of it or don't like the, you know, the, like you said, I mean, its underpinnings weren't all fact, and that's a problem. However, at least he showed us something about what his honest opinion was. And if we want more of that, we can't pick and choose when we're frustrated by what he says. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, I get it. And I'm not, you know, again, I'm not against Blake Snell speaking out. And I'm never going to be a guy who argues that people shouldn't speak their mind. That's bad for our business. But in terms of evaluating the volley back and forth between players and owners, I think that was a point for the owners. So it doesn't personally offend me what he said. But if we're navigating kind of the public perception of this, I think that was that's what I meant by step back, just because I think he opened up the door for people who are just as misinformed to say, oh, you know, millionaire player whining about not wanting to play. And, you know, it visually just it catered to that chorus of people who are looking to rip the players. And, you know, I've been more on the player's side of this thing, but I've stressed time and time again that they cannot put themselves in that box of being guys who are being perceived as whining about money to play baseball. And they should use the opportunity to shine the light back on the owners, guys who are whining about having more money than the players and owning baseball teams. I mean, they have an opportunity there to say, hey, we're the ones who play the game. We're the ones who you buy our uniforms. You know, let's look at, you know, the other side of this. And I feel like too often, you know, the owners win at that PR battle. And we see how it happens. We've watched it play out. The owners get Rob Manfred on CNN. The owners have leaked every single proposal that they've come up with to writers who've then written it and then say, hey, here's our proposal that we're going to actually present to the players. Go ahead and print it before the players see it. So the clock had started on public animosity building toward the players not accepting this deal before the players had even seen the deal. And it's
it's pretty genius. Yeah.
Well,
because you put the players in a position to refute the return, right? Like
correct.
The owners are the good guys.
Right.
They want to return. Here's our plan to return. And that's like, it's like they forever have serve in tennis, right? Or
correct.
They forever have serve in ping pong is because they are the ones that are putting the ball in play for the, you know, for the players to respond to. They are constantly in the positive light because they get to position themselves as we are the ones that are taking action to return. And the players then are on the defensive saying, wait, we're trying to avoid some bad hops here. Or, you know, we need to return serve. Just give us a second. So by nature of negotiations, the owners are in a better position. But it sounds like you're saying, too, that the owners are better at messaging.
Well, absolutely. And it's not surprising that they are. There's 30 owners and they all have similar kind of opinions on this stuff. Look at the opinions of players and look how many there are and look how many differences there are. I mean, you know,
right.
for a fact that for every Blake Snell that's worried about his health, there's a guy who would have been playing 2 months ago if he could have. There are just as many baseball players, maybe more, who think coronavirus is a hoax than there are who think it's serious. There, and that's not to say that, you know, that's not to label baseball players. Their opinions are as diverse as they are their financial situations. Some veterans who have a pile of money in the bank might not be as motivated financially to come back and risk this even for less money than a guy who's, you know, looking for that next contract. So the players has always been at a disadvantage when it comes to messaging because A, there's more of them, and B, their opinions vary quite greatly compared to the owners, which is even more of a reason to try to avoid easy to dodge pitfalls, like Blake Snell said. Now, I'm not ever going to tell a guy not to talk. I'm not a shut up and dribble guy, but you know, I do think if you're scoring this thing, that was a step back, and hopefully the players learn from it and say, hey, we need to be not only smarter about who we're having as our ambassadors here, but I think also, you know, more opportunistic in trying to have their side of it. I mean, we've really seen the players do that I thought was substantial was Scott Boras writing a letter to the New York Times. Now, Scott Boras has just as many motivations here as anybody because he makes money when games are played. And his shtick was all about, hey, baseball's going to help us heal. And then he turns around the same week and rips this proposal. That puts him in a bad spot. So, you know, I would like to hear from some players who have thoughts on this that are, you know, I thought one example of a guy who's really, I thought, been handling this the right way in an informative way and still facing backlash of it, but that's inevitable, is Sean Doolittle, who has been, very,
totally agree,
very outspoken. You know, I think you've also seen a guy like Adam Jones, right? Who's not, you know, he's not even in the league, but encouraging players to, you know, find a message and stick with it and encouraging the faces of the league to say, hey, you guys have an opportunity to speak out on some of these things, take it. And it's not comfortable for some of these guys to do that. But if they want to, you know, if they care about this PR battle, and maybe they don't, and I'm not saying everybody should, but if they feel like they're being backed into a corner, there are some guys who could get that message out. I'm pretty sure if Blake Snell wanted to go on CNN to talk about Rob Manfred's statements after Rob Manfred finished, I guarantee you CNN would have taken that interview.
Yeah, I don't know. Like that is part of the question that I have and part of what's been kind of I've been thinking a lot about. I was caught on my heels a little bit during the chat there Monday, and I continue to be, even like in the emails that I get, that fans so often in discussions like this take the side of the owners and you know, there are times like during the season where it's like the same fans go out of their way to defend players. Like, you know, a player doesn't come through in the clutch to win a game, and all of a sudden it's the hitting coach's fault. It's the manager's fault. It's the media for not asking the right question before the game that got that hitter out of that spot. And, you know, it's like you go on this long distance journey to avoid ever blaming the players. And yet in this conversation, it's like the direct route to why do the millionaires have an issue with this? Why do the millionaires have an issue with this? You know, clearly the billionaires are the good guys. And I'm fascinated by that. I don't really have a good reason. Some people have sent me emails with suggestions as to why that is. One email I got argued that it's because fans are mostly self-employed and run their own business and therefore empathize with the owners. I don't know if there's any data that would back that up. I don't think that that's the case. It could be the old argument that it's easier to visualize $1 million than it is to visualize $1,000 million, which is what a billionaire is. So it's easier to be angry at that. I don't know, but it does seem like, you know, the workers should get some benefit of the doubt here. They're in the arena. They're at risk. Their careers are short and maybe not all that, rewarding in a lot of cases. The best, the elite, the long-term players make a lot of money, but a lot of the players are just trying to make enough so that, you know, it lasts them for a while after a short window of their professional career. You know, we talk about like the average length of a professional major leaguer's career. I'm going to suggest that the average length of a major league owner's career as an owner is a lot longer, and the chance to make money is a lot more. And the physical risk, business risk aside, which is a real thing, but the physical risk is way different. So I don't know how the players have fallen so behind in the messaging game and maybe it's just the loudest of fans. Maybe it's just the social media fans. But I think there is an element of the message too, like that, you know, owners have a more appealing message just because they get to start off from the positive corner.
Well, I think it's a few things. One is kind of the dynamic that we talked about. If you could make a case right now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with it, but you could make the case that the owners have come up with a plan that would bring baseball back. And all that is being waited on is the players to approve it. And that's how the owners will present this. The other thing I think
is their job.
Right.
It's not the player's job to come up with a plan to return.
No, but you can see how that can be phrased. Hey, we came up with a plan.
Absolutely.
And they wouldn't agree with it. So then therefore it gets, and that's how it's always gone. I mean, go back to the public perception of the players at the last strike. I mean, the owners have always done a better job of this. The other thing I think is this, and maybe this will be blown up by someone who knows more about psychology than I do, but I think there's a couple things in play when it comes to this. The fans, the average fan, people who follow baseball, they know the players much better than they know the people who run the teams. They're more familiar. Right. They feel like they have a better relationship with them. They talk about them at their house more than, say, an owner. Now, that might be a little different here in St. Louis, but I think across the board. So they're more familiar with the player. And the other thing, too, is I think so many baseball fans have played the game or, you know, wanted to play the game at a high level that there's almost – a tiny degree, a shade of like almost resentment of the notion of you have a chance to play Major League Baseball. And, you know, there are people who would pay to do that. There are people who pay to do that. Handsome sums to go to Cardinals fantasy camp and pretend they're a Cardinal for a day. So the notion of players not playing, you know, players not taking nothing to play just for the fact that they get to put on the Major League uniform, there is some, I don't even know if it's acknowledged, but resentment toward, I think, that. And then you factor in the animosity toward bad contracts, you know, the notion that some players get money to play hurt or get hurt or get money for contracts they don't perform on. Then the notion of almost it is the players owe it to the game to make up for some of the bad money that has been spent. You can justify those things in your head. But I do think a lot of it is like, hey, I played the game. I would have loved to play at a high level. I would have loved to be a pro athlete. So how can you how can the idea of not playing for millions, you know, how can a common fan, you know, mesh that? You know, it takes an understanding of the business side. It takes a full kind of appreciation of the nuance, and some people prefer not to have that.
That's a really great point, Ben. And I mean, it's that vicarious notion a little bit, like, you know, I could have been, if this had broken my way, I could have been, or I could have reached, I could have done this in my career if only I had been given an opportunity. They did, you know, make the most of it, but don't turn your back on it. And you're right. Maybe it's a failing on my part too, because, you know, I do think about it as a career, not a game. And, you know, like, you're right. There's elements of that, you know, you tell fans, hey, players don't make money during spring training. They don't. They're there to make the money during the regular season. Players aren't making money now. You know, there's some bonuses that they get, but you know, there have been few articles that, like, Prince Fielder could be the highest paid player this year. And how long has it been since he played?
Right.
That's because of the guarantee of his contract. So players aren't played during the, you know, during spring training. There are elements of this that, like, I get it, are hard to, you know, like, it's hard to ask fans to look past the zeros and the commas into that stuff. And maybe that's unfair, but there is an element definitely where, like, I struggle to understand that, partially because I see it as a career and an hours of commitment, and also a career that gathers thousands to watch. You and I, we don't have a career where thousands of people are interested in watching us type. There aren't people buying tickets for the recording of the best podcast in baseball, you know, and they're certainly not going to pay premium prices for that or rent out a luxury box for doing that. You know, if people did, if we had corporations lining up the luxury boxes to watch a live recording of BPIB, we'd probably make more money. But our skills aren't, I'll go ahead and say it, we're not elite. You know, I struggle with the sound sometimes, but so I do kind of see it in that frame, as an entertainment spot. So how then, let's kind of look at it this way. How then do the players reclaim the message? What can they do? What would be some recommendations for them to regain some traction in the public perception at this point?
I mean, that's a good question. Hopefully they're thinking about that. And to give myself some time to think of some suggestions, I just want to touch on one thing that we talked about, because, you know, I think you and I both see the player side of this while acknowledging the owner side as well. But I'll say this, the time to have this discussion, players versus owners, is not now. And I think that's how the players start.
Great point.
Is, you know, I mean, and I, you know, I will be, you know, an advocate to say, hey, here's some things you should think about if you're mad at the players, and here's maybe why you should consider, you know, looking at the owner side of this a little bit more critically. But I'm not going to sit here and say to a parent who has lost a job, who's trying to homeschool, you know, their kids, and is trying to figure out how to make ends meet, that they are not going to be, that they shouldn't be turned off by the idea of baseball season not happening because of money. I don't blame them for the resentment that's fostered in that at all. That's why the number one thing for players and owners was to avoid letting this discussion turn into millionaires versus billionaires, which unfortunately it seems to be turning into that. So that would be my thing with the players, would be win the ground that's up for grabs by saying, hey, we want to get the game back because we want to give folks a distraction, and we want to do it safely, and we don't want to put our health in unnecessary risk to do it, but we're not going to make this about the money. However, they should do that with an appeal to the owners to, let's make sure that this money stuff gets worked out when we're back to booming business. You know, that's why I would suggest, you know, seeking those kind of deferred payments that make up any difference, that can get the players back to what they initially thought that they would be getting. But, you know, I think whatever group has a chance to win the public opinion is the one that, you know, leads the charge on getting it back. And right now, neither group has. The owners have suggested a plan that they knew the players weren't going to accept, and the players have said, you knew we weren't going to accept that. So that opportunity is still up for grabs. But, you know, let the big fight about money come down to the collective bargaining agreement. You know, let that happen after 2021. Don't make that the centerpiece of this, because right now the public doesn't have a stomach for it. And I don't blame them for that.
I think back to spring training, and one of the revelations of spring was how much fun fans and players had watching those games when players were mic'd up. And you had, you know, Freddie Freeman calling his shot at the plate as it was happening. Rizzo and Bryant going back and forth. And I understand that this is a Cardinals podcast, and I'm going to praise two Cubs here, but you know, they had a great time doing that, you know, and what one of them was wearing the wrong cap. You know, the Rizzo in the middle of a bat predicted what kind of pitch he was going to get. And, you know, we watched that. We saw that recreate, you know, passed around on social media. People celebrated it. Players the next day were talking about it. You had Pete Alonso, you know, the report out of New York, that Pete Alonso and Major League Baseball had agreed to put a mic at first base there at Citi Field to catch his interactions with players. And he was committed to saying, all right, I'm going to be a conversationalist at first base so that you guys catch that audio. I am going to engage in opponents just so it creates that atmosphere. I think that was a revelation of spring, and people saw the personality of some of the best personalities and best players. I don't think anybody could have watched that game, you know, who wasn't a Braves fan, maybe didn't know much about the Braves beyond the fact that they have an MVP caliber, you know, contending first baseman there, Freddie Freeman. I don't think you could have walked away from that and not gone, man, Freddie Freeman, man, what a guy to listen to. What a guy to talk to. Anthony Rizzo, who has done a lot of good things. You know, you've written about some of the great things that he's done. Very personable, very funny, very well-spoken, very articulate, all of these things. And yet, where are these guys? I think that is one element of reclaiming. I hate the use of this word, but I do think that that's one element of reclaiming a foothold in the narrative, is that it's not like Sean Doolittle does a great job, and he's a top flight reliever.
Right.
Andrew Miller, the Cardinals lefty, you know, he's very involved in this. He's on the executive subcommittee. He's in there, and he knows it cold, and he talks great about it, and he brings up great points, and he's very thoughtful, and he is an elite reliever. You know, Blake Snell, former Cy Young Award winner, plays for the Tampa Bay Rays. The union would benefit here by identifying some of the messengers who can do a better job getting the message out. Where is the script for Bryce Harper to go on CNN?
And, yeah, I mean, let me. That's a good point. Great group. Maybe Blake Snell could not have gotten the Manfred follow up.
Right. You know, I mean, I said, you look at
maybe
like,
Blake Snell could have, but Harper would have. Mike Trout
right,
would
that's
have.
That's exactly right. And instead, Harper's taking to Instagram to share his point. You know, where's the interview on MLB, you know, tonight where a player like Anthony Rizzo says, we want to do everything possible to come back and play. And here are some of our ideas for how to make that possible. Here's what we're presenting to the owners. Here's where we agree. You know, so much of this, we want conflict. We cover conflict, right? And that's what drives headlines and drives news. It's leaked emails, proposals, conflict, right? However, you can change the conversation. If you can't change the coverage, you can change the conversation by being more proactive with what is being proposed. The players can, you know, break serve, so to speak, to go back to the tennis analogy, by saying, here's what we want to do and how important it is for us to be a part of it. And they just have to look at the messengers. I mean, I think, you know, if a guy, if the 2016 Cubs did some kind of reunion like the cast of Goonies did or the cast of Back to the Future did, you know, it would capture the imagination of fans and put, you know, players, I don't know if you had a chance to see some of the Zooms that the Blues did, right? Didn't they do some team Zooms?
They did, yeah. If the 2016 Cubs did that, though, then Dexter Fowler would get a lot of heat for participating.
You know what? We can get over it. But imagine if that took place, right? Like, yeah. Imagine if that took place. That would get attention. These players have agents and groups and marketing and everybody who is all about messaging for, well, I mean, some players do, right? But it's about messaging for the individual and the brand and all that notion, right? What if they put that effort towards the messaging of the union? What if there was a advertisement that ran on MLB Network from the union that was just players talking about how they missed the game and wanted to get back to it healthy and ready and be part of buoying the country? Wouldn't that change the conversation?
Absolutely. I mean, put Chris Bryant in an ad where he says, yeah, they just want us to play. I just wanted to play when the Cubs wouldn't bring me up. You know,
right.
And here's why. Yeah. And here's why the argument is more complicated than that. I mean, if you could have Chris
put him on an interview. Yeah. You know,
absolutely. And I mean, and then that's, I think it's a missed opportunity. And you're right. You know, that was a great analogy, is we don't hear from the Trouts and the Judges. We hear from the Snells and the, you know, and the Doolittles, which, you know, credit to those guys, but they don't have the pull of the faces of the game.
It's happening on a large scale, what has happened over time in the clubhouse, where it's the relievers who are available for us every day and, you know, not always the stars. And that's just how it goes. But it's one thing that, you know, I've had talks with the union about and relievers are aware about. I've talked with many veteran relievers who are like, we're the ones who have to answer for the larger questions, the themed questions and everything like that, because we're available. We think it's important to be available. It's part of our, you know, it's part of the culture of the bullpen to be available. Often overlooked when they do well, but standing there waiting for interviews when they blow a game, that's just kind of the culture, and it's passed down from veterans, you know, to the young guys, and the young guys then pass it down. I mean, you see it, we see it happen. Pat Neshek and Russ Springer and, you know, Randy Choate and these guys who were there out in the Cardinals bullpen and spoke to the young relievers about what it was like to, you know, to stand there and answer questions after a blown game. And then, of course, you see Segrist and Seth Maness do it. And then you got Jason Mott, who then did it. And then Trevor Rosenthal was there. And now you see that passed down to a John Brebbia, who saw it from guys before him. And he's the one who's now letting guys know, like Daniel Ponce de Leon. And, you know, it's on and on and on. And that's a great part of the clubhouse culture. And it's one of the reasons why, like, people who are listening to this podcast, you might see, you know, some more quotes from relievers every so often than, say, the prominent players. But right now, when the message is so important, so too is the messenger. And the union has a stockade of talent to draw from to create a spokesman. So where is that?
Well, the best spokespeople for the union are also the people who are getting paid the most by the owners. So, you know, there's a real pressure there. You know, if Mike Trout is the guy who's sticking it to the owners, then the owners are going to say, hey, look at your contract, buddy. And that pressure is real. I mean, we've seen that happen with the Cardinals. I mean, if somebody says something that ruffles the front office, they hear about it.
That's a good point.
Go back to Adam Wainwright predicting a strike at spring training, and how, you know, Adam didn't apologize for his comments, but he did clarify them very quickly. And I'll give him credit. I'll give Adam credit too, because in his conversation with Rick Hummel, he didn't necessarily weigh in on the specifics, but he did say that he's frustrated by the amount of information that gets out before players have a chance to view it. And he feels like that puts players in a bad spot sometimes. I'm paraphrasing here, but he did say what I think a lot of people, you know, appreciated, which is that he doesn't want this to turn into a fight between rich baseball players and richer baseball owners. So, you know, he has opinions and he's willing to let them air out a little bit. And I think, you know, he was really stressing that, hey, the players want to play, and hopefully we can get a plan that puts this forth. So anything that suggests that we don't or that we're delaying this is not the case. So there's an example of a guy who says, yeah, I will speak my mind on this. But you're right. You know, if Adam Wainwright is doing this, you know, when Adam Wainwright is an annual All-Star, it probably does carry more weight. And that's not a shot at Adam at all. But it does seem like the guys in their prime are maybe hesitant for all kinds of different reasons, for endorsement reasons, for, for pressure from their bosses. And they're a little quiet when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah. Well, then this is where we're at. Because if that doesn't change, if the messenger doesn't change, then, you know, I don't see, you know, the owners have such a machine, when it comes to delivering and producing and amplifying their message, it's going to be hard for the players to kind of reposition the conversation. We didn't dive into the granular levels of the 67-page proposal. Was there anything that stood out to you that you wanted to touch on briefly with it? I mean, how feasible is it for a pitcher who has been in the game for 15 years not to lick his fingers? How feasible is it for a team to watch a teammate deliver a 3-run homer to upend the opponent in the bottom of the ninth inning, not to rush him? How realistic are some of these things? How significant of a muscle memory change are they asking?
Well, some of this is eyewash, and will be. I think the question will be, how is it enforced? Is it shrugged off, or is it a gradual system of warning before are you going to remove somebody from a game because he licked his fingers on the mound? I have a hard time seeing how that works without becoming a circus. I have a hard time seeing how players aren't going to run out to the home plate and push each other around when Jose Altuve gets whopped with the first fastball of the season whenever it starts.
Great point.
It's just going to happen. I mean,
that's a great point. You can't have the benches clearing. What are they going to do? What are the Astros going to do? The Astros are just exposed out there. That's a brilliant point, Ben.
The Astros want 2020 rules to be in effect forever. No fans in the stands, and you can't have benches clearing draws. This is like, oh, by the way, if they don't have a season, then Luhnow and Hinch could be back the next year. Great. It works out great for Houston.
Luhnow's going to have a heck of a memoir that he wrote this year.
Good. Yeah. I can't wait to read about it in the Wall Street Journal. I'll just say, you know, some of this stuff is silly. Like, you're not going to have players show up to their uniforms. What about if it's a getaway day? Are they not supposed to shower at the ballpark before getting on a plane? So some of this stuff I think is goofy, but I will say this, there are some things that kind of make sense. The most important being the plan for testing. This notion that you can have players in a bubble and then go home to people who are not and not test those people that they're around is bogus. So it does seem like there's a plan for that. I thought it was a good PR move to open up testing for, you know, healthcare and frontline workers in the area.
Absolutely.
When they're doing the stadiums. Now, that's great if you can get enough tests. We'll see if enough are available. And I thought the plans to try to nip things in the bud, the regular checks, in the regular tests, the antibody tests, might actually work when it comes to inevitably probably having some people who can't be around because they are under precaution or they're potentially have the virus without derailing everything. Because if your whole plan was to never let someone get it and get through an 82 game season and a postseason with that approach, then it was never going to work. So having some real buffers in place, I think is a good idea. Some of the stuff about what happens inside the bubble, I think will probably fade. I mean, I don't know if the whole thing is engineered around keeping guys in a more or less a bubble and having different points of entry that catch problems before they get too deep into the game, then I really don't know what the point of having them sit 6 feet apart in the dugout is, because the premise would be that everybody inside the bubble should be okay. Keep guys who are at risk away from the field. Don't worry so much about what they do when they're on it.
Right. No, and that's going to take some responsibility from the teams and also some discipline from the players. And that's the bigger part of this, I think, that kind of brings it all together. Is this notion of the players may not be able to control the narrative, but when they do come to an agreement, they should at least be acknowledged that they took a leap of faith, whether that's a faith in the owners when it comes to how they define revenue, or whether that's a faith in the testing protocols and their own peers to maintain those testing protocols and those habits off the field and on the field and everything like that. I think that should be more celebrated than it probably will be, is this notion that the players, by taking the field to bring the game back and making this agreement, are in effect making a leap of faith. And if you're frustrated because they make a lot of money and you don't want to look at that element of it, that they are trusting the owners to define what revenue is, then at least look at the habits and the practices and the meticulous detail that they're going to have to undertake and the discipline that they are going to add to their already disciplined pursuit of the game in order to make that happen. I think that that's a real element here, that the players are going to have to take a communal and personal leap of faith to bring the game back that just might be overlooked.
Yeah, and I think the important thing to remember there is that, you know, remember who's on the field. Remember who's traveling to these cities and who's on the road, you know, basically turning their hotel into a, you know, I don't want to say jail because that's a reach, but a quarantine zone, you know, not going out to have dinners and things of that nature. I mean, it's a really unlike anything that's ever happened before. And it's going to take some sacrifices. Now, if your brain is unable to accept that people who make a lot of money, make a lot more money than us, have to make sacrifices, then that will be a non-starter. But if that's the way your brain works, and remember that above the players are the owners, and they make a lot more money than the players.
Right. Well, let me close here then, Ben, with this idea that we've now arrived at. Is there are significant hurdles for baseball to come back. There is significant acrimony, as we've detailed, between the owners and the players. There's distrust that is now there on public view. There is a strong messaging machine behind the owners and scattered subplots of social media commentary by the players. So there are a lot of odds stacked against the return of baseball just by looking at that. And then you throw in the fact of the virus and the narrow window in which they want to get the season accomplished and completed by the end of the postseason in case there is a second wave. You have all these factors going in. This is my question. What cause is there for optimism unless the power of the game, just the mere power of baseball, is able to overcome the business of baseball? Is baseball that much? I mean, it has weathered a lot. It has played through wars. It has come back from labor stoppages. It has, you know, it has been dismissed as an important sport, and yet it still exists every day of our life until recently. So is the power of little B baseball enough to overcome capital Big B business baseball?
I hope it is. And I'm optimistic that there will be some sort of a middle ground that can be found here. I think baseball owes it to its fans to attempt to let this season get derailed by the coronavirus as opposed to dollars and cents. That's if there's a plan in place that players feel comfortable with health wise, you know, I'm not talking about they say they don't feel comfortable health wise because they don't like the money. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if there's a plan in place that truly makes players feel like they can try to play without taking unnecessary risks to their well being, that then let the pandemic be the what ends this season or rings out hope for it, not the posturing. Because if that's the case, then, you know, you're going to get what, maybe one season before a strike. And I think both sides would have to agree that a missed 2020 season, one 2021 season, if they're ready to come back, if we're at a place where they can come back, that it immediately leads into what's likely a work stoppage before the next CBA. They will, nobody will like what baseball looks like coming out of that, if that happens.
And that is your daily moment of Zen. Thanks, Ben.
I'm just an optimistic way to end it. That's all. I've tried to be upbeat.
Yeah. I like how you began that answer by saying I'm optimistic. And then here's all the reasons that rust and corrosive elements and, you know, you go, here's, I'm really optimistic. And then you handed us a big fat wad of an eraser to then scrape out elements of that optimism. No, that's good. That's good.
I'm optimistic here.
Thank you.
No, here, let me rephrase it. I can rephrase it. I'm optimistic that little B baseball will win out because I don't think big B baseball likes the idea of the potential of having one season over the next three.
Well, potentially. I have learned never to doubt, and I'm biased. I'm little B biased. No, I'm capital B biased, but I have learned to never doubt the power of little B baseball. And I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because
it's a scrappy means a lot to a lot of
people. Yeah. And I think baseball, you know, is ubiquitous presence, its constance is its strength, as well as its weakness. But its constance would be a strength right now. And, you know, I hope that big B baseball doesn't get in the way of little B baseball. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, man, this was fun.
Yeah. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Claude. Okay, cool. All right. I'm going to sign off real quick. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Get you organized by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. That's Closet by Design. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN, 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closet by Design, the official sponsor of your back to a weekly format, best podcast in baseball. You can find all of Ben's work at stltoday.com and in the pages of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. There have been no games, but there has been constant Cardinals coverage going on. We have a big project that we're going to roll out in the near future that is both a look at the present situation of the Cardinals minor league system and the future of the major league team. I'm looking forward to that. Ben will have all sorts of commentary coming. He has his chat every Tuesday, and he hosts a podcast with Dave Matter about Mizzou. We then also have the Sports on Tap, which is May 27th at 7:15. Where can people find out more information about that, Ben?
They can simply go to our website. If you go to stltoday.com/ontap, you can sign up and even receive an event reminder and submit questions early for the roundtable.
The best podcast is available wherever you get your... You know what? If people have listened this far, they know where to get the best podcast in baseball. Please subscribe to the best podcast in baseball. If you subscribe to the podcast, it makes the sponsorships possible, and the sponsorship make the podcast possible. You've heard me all say it before, and if you've gotten this far, you probably already subscribed. So I'm just going to say thank you. Thank you for continuing to subscribe through all this. Thank you for joining us week after week, especially for the past 2 months. The strength of this podcast is the community that has supported it and flocked to it and has helped me make it better through all the years. And here we are in year 8 of it. So enough of the sales pitch for offering reviews and writing and plugging stars and subscriptions and everything like that. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for being there for the best podcast in baseball so the BPIB can keep coming back to you. For St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist Ben Fredrickson and the best podcast in baseball, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. We'll talk to you soon, and we'll have more to talk about inevitably. Things change every day. Are you going to rearrange your books for Sports on Tap? Or are you going to do a Zoom background? What's your plans for the Sports on Tap Zoom back? Like, what should I do?
I think we should both arrange our books so that the like kind of like the library does when it tweets out pictures. We should send a message on the spines of the book, like an SOS of sorts, or maybe a message to owners and players, perhaps.
That would be epic. You and I should have a challenge of trying to create a sentence out of our books behind us.
I like it. I like that. And then you can have, you know, I also was wondering, maybe we should ask, should this be on Twitch, the Sports on Tap? I feel like everybody's on Twitch. I don't even know what it is. We got to get on there. I think you can be on Twitch if you don't play video games. I don't know. Someone let me know about that.
I'm going to ask the younger member of my family. He'll know.
Yeah.
I have a hard enough time getting the sound right on this podcast.
I'm twitchy, so I don't know if that counts.